Mr. Chairman and friends, one of the objects of the Theosophical Society, as was stated just now by the chairman, is to investigate unexplained laws of nature and powers latent in man. Physical science studies nature and places before man certain laws governing the behavior of but life is so manifold, life is so intensely dynamic, that there are many aspects of life which remain unexplained in spite of scientific investigations. The process of science is the process whereby the observer studies the observed from the outside. In all scientific methods, whether that science is of the physical phenomenon or of the superphysical phenomenon, wherever science studies anything, there is always a duality of the observer and the observed, of the subject and the object, of the perceiver and the perceived. It is knowledge from outside. This category of knowledge is known as knowledge by ideation. But there is another category of knowledge, which is knowledge by being, where the subject knows the object not from outside but by some mysterious process becoming that object itself. It is this category of knowledge, not knowledge by ideation but knowledge by being, which sometimes is known as wisdom. And it is this wisdom which is the subject matter so far as yoga is concerned. Yoga concerns itself with knowledge by being and not so much with knowledge by ideation. Now yoga is a Sanskrit word. It is a subject which has been much discussed and investigated about in the Eastern religions, particularly of the Hindus and the Buddhists. But I would like to suggest that even though the term yoga may be from Eastern religions, its fundamental nature is to be found in all the religions of the world. Where you turn to the mysticism of religion, there you come across the fundamentals of yoga. And mysticism is to be found in all the great religions of the world. The Hindus describe their mysticism as Vedanta. The Buddhists turn to mysticism when they describe their Zen Buddhism. The Muslims, they speak of mysticism when they relate to us the experiences of Sufism. Similarly, in Christianity, there is a mysticism, the Christian mysticism, and as you turn to it, you find the fundamental basis of yoga, where the Christ said, "I and my Father are one." This surely is a mystical statement. And therefore, it is the statement of Christian yoga. My subject this evening is practical yoga. But let me say at the very outset that there are not two yogas, one practical and something else which is impractical. All yoga is practical. Although there is a misconception in the minds of many that yoga can be practiced only by the few. That for the practice of yoga, one has to retire into jungle or cave, that one has to go into cloistered existence, as it were, as otherwise yoga cannot be understood. I wish to state that yoga is for everybody. A person, whatever may be his profession, wherever he may be standing at a particular moment, for him, yoga has a message, for yoga is intensely practical. Was it not said by the Christ that my yoke is easy and my burden is light? The path of yoga that he indicated was not the path of difficulty, not the path which was only for the few. Because he says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. The burden of yoga is light indeed. But for whom? He who is interested in it. If you have had a vision of the Mount Everest, then every step towards the Mount Everest is full of joy and delight. The climber to the Everest does not then talk of the ruggedness of the path. The path is difficult for one who has had no vision. But when the vision comes, the difficulties of the path disappear. And there is a joy and a thrill from moment to moment. When a deep interest is awakened, when life is perceived with deep awareness, then there is no difficulty whatsoever so far as the treading of the path is concerned. Life then becomes a series of joys and delights. Even the ruggedness becomes a great adventure, provided there has come to the individual the great vision of life. It is the purpose of yoga to give to the human individual that vision, so that having seen that which is indescribable, having seen that which is ineffable, there is joy and delight in the day-to-day existence of such an individual. As I said, there are all types of misconceptions about yoga. 2 years ago, when I was touring in the United Kingdom, I was moving about in the subways and in the tube trains at several railway stations in London. I found a poster very prominently displayed, and when I read that poster, I was for the time being taken aback. What did this poster say? It had displayed, as I said, prominently one thing, and that was yoga in one day. Yoga in one day was the display on those posters. As I said, I was taken aback. One can understand yoga in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, but yoga in one day certainly is something very tall, and it shows the utter misconception so far as yoga is concerned. Sometimes yoga is thought of in terms of some fantastic feats. A person swallowing certain quantity of iron nails or pieces of glass is considered a yogi. Sometimes he who moves with long hair and a peculiar look in his eyes is regarded as a yogi. Very often, yoga is associated with certain superphysical powers, certain powers which are not normal to the human individual. May I suggest that all these things, they are beside the mark so far as the fundamentals of yoga are concerned. Sometimes yoga is considered as the process of breath control, or sometimes yoga is considered as taking up certain postures of the physical body. May I state that even breath control and the keeping of certain postures, these are not fundamentals to yoga. Although certain amount of breath control is certainly necessary for any individual who wants to lead a life of spirituality, a certain amount of breath control becomes necessary, just as certain amount of control over physical movements is essential. If you examine the rhythm of your breath, you will find that very often our breathing is very fast and very shallow. And fast and shallow breathing is, from one standpoint, a reflection of an agitated and an excited mind. When you are agitated or excited, just examine your breathing, and you will find that during such moments, breathing has become more shallow and it has become more quick. In processes of yoga, in leading spiritual life, one has to come to a rhythm of breathing where breathing is slow and it is deep. Slow breathing and deep breathing are very, very necessary, and it is by this process that to a certain extent man can come to a quiet and the tranquility of human mind. I deliberately say to a certain extent. Although mind's tranquility cannot be brought about in its fundamental aspect by only the processes of breathing, nevertheless, the exact rhythm of one's breathing is of great importance so far as yoga and its practices are concerned. Similarly, a certain physical control, so that one can take up a posture which is neither too tense nor too relaxed, is also useful for all processes of yoga. If you want to quietly reflect, if you want to go into meditation, if you want to come to a state of prayer, it is necessary that the body is neither too tense nor is it too relaxed, so that a middle position has to be found out. A middle position has to be discovered by the human individual so that he may be able to carry on his reflection, carry on his meditation, or carry on his prayers in an effective manner. But apart from this, breathing and physical postures have not much to contribute so far as the fundamentals of yoga are concerned. There are in Hinduism and Buddhism recognized several systems of yoga. Some systems of yoga concentrate on the physical aspect. Some systems of yoga emphasize the repetition of certain sentences. Certain other aspects of yoga deal with controlled activity. But to me it seems that there is one system of yoga which has, as it were, synthesized all the various systems, and that is what is known in India as Raja Yoga or the Kingly Yoga, the Yoga of Yogas. And it is to this yoga that I wish to invite your attention this evening while studying this vast and fascinating subject of practical yoga. This Raja Yoga, the Kingly Yoga, is concerned fundamentally with the control of the human mind. The controlled human mind can do so much, can comprehend so much, can come to that wisdom about which I spoke in the very beginning. Now we must understand that a controlled mind is not a rigid mind. It is not a set mind. It is not a restricted mind. A controlled mind is a pliable mind. A mind that can be used as an instrument. A mind that is so pliable. A mind that is so dynamic that it can listen to the faintest whisper of the soul. It is to this mind that the attention of the spiritual aspirant is turned so far as the study of Raja Yoga is concerned. In all systems of yoga, and particularly this system of yoga about which I am speaking, the emphasis is on the restoration of wholeness. Yoga means union, and union means wholeness. Man's consciousness is divided, diffused, distracted, and it is because of this that he is not able to comprehend the unexplained laws of nature. He is not able to understand many a mystery of human existence. It is therefore necessary that he must come to the wholeness of consciousness, that his consciousness must be brought to its original condition of wholeness. In other words, there must come into existence what is known as integrated living. Integrated living, therefore, is the fundamental basis so far as yoga is concerned. And I would like to suggest that it is this integrated living which has become absolutely necessary in the age in which we live today. This is an age of psychological frustration. An age of psychosis and neurosis. An age of psychological maladjustments. It is in the midst of these psychological frustrations that man is today in need of an integrated life. He is disintegrated within. He is broken up within. And that is why he imparts to the world in which he lives this factor of disintegration. In this age, no doubt, we have shown this miraculous aspect of the conquest of matter. But we must understand that the conquest of matter by itself will not lead man to happiness and peace and prosperity. If the conquest of matter is not within the background of the conquest of the mind, if the conquest of the mind is not taking place, if man is not able to resolve his psychological crisis, if man is not able to break up the psychological complexes within himself, if man does not free himself from the aspects of psychological maladjustment that are to be seen in his life, then it is possible that the mere conquest of matter will lead us to war after war and ultimately to the total destruction of humanity. It is therefore necessary that in this age of psychological maladjustments, we turn our attention more and more to the integrated living, to the breaking up of the psychological complexes of man. As I said, our mind is disturbed, distracted. The consciousness is completely divided. It is because of this that we see tremendous restlessness. Everywhere there is a restlessness. The other day, I was talking to a businessman in Melbourne. I told him, "You are here in a country which knows economic security, a country in which there is no poverty whatsoever, a country in which the state and the society give to man every conceivable facility." And I asked him, "Why is it that you are still restless? Why do you find such problems of frustration in your country?" And this businessman pointed out to a television set which was in his house. He said, "There is a television set. It is a set of 17 inches screen. I'm not satisfied because I must have a television set with a screen of 21 inches. That is my problem." And he said that, "I'm sure that manufacturer after manufacturer will produce bigger and bigger screens, and therefore I shall move from one restlessness to another restlessness, because I must possess that which either my neighbor is possessing or something which even my neighbor is not able to possess, so that I can feel more significant and important than my neighbor." Tremendous restlessness is there. And this restlessness is due to the fact that we have not understood the processes of our own mind. If we can understand the processes of our own mind, then we shall be able to feel happy in the conditions in which we live, even though such contentment will not result in a static existence. It will not result in a condition of staleness, while all the time we shall be moving. But in every movement there shall be a contentment, provided we understand the processes, the reactions, the operations of our own mind. Our minds are restless. while we sit in prayer or in meditation, we are hardly able to apply our mind to that which we want to do. We are somewhat in the condition of that Hindu pupil who went to his master seeking advice as to how he should meditate. And the master told his pupil, "Go and meditate on any subject you like, but do not meditate on the monkey." And the pupil went into meditation. 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. He came out of the meditation and the master asked him, "What did you meditate on?" And the pupil said, "I could not meditate on any other subject except the monkey." Because, he said, "I was constantly trying to put away the thought of the monkey, with the result that I had no time to think about anything else." To me it seems most of us are in this condition. We are not able to apply our mind to anything with the fullest of attention because of the constant distractions, the constant pulls that we experience in our life. The result of this is that our actions from day to day remain incomplete. Our experiences from day to day remain incomplete. Because when we cannot give our total attention to anything, some part of the experience remains incomplete. And so we move in life, piling up incomplete experience after incomplete experience. It is this which becomes the storehouse of our memory, and it is this which constantly pulls us in the midst of our diverse activities. The constant pull of memory is indeed the distraction so far as the human mind is concerned. It is therefore necessary that man must be free from distractions if he is to give his total, his complete attention to anything, because without such attention, he cannot understand life which faces him. It was this which was pointed out to you in your Christian scripture, when the Christ said, "It is only as you become like little children that you can enter the kingdom of God." We have to become like little children. What does it mean? We have to come to a child state of consciousness. What is the child state of consciousness? The child state of consciousness is an undistracted state. Look at a child. Whatever may be the experience, the total being of the child is in that experience. The child is not cut up into different parts of consciousness. The child's consciousness is not diffused, but the total being of the child is present in any particular set of experience. It is to such a child state that we have to come if we would move along the path of psychological integration. Now therefore, yoga is described in all Hindu books as that state which is characterized by the non-distraction of the human mind. One of the definitions of yoga that is given is that yoga is the complete cessation of the modifications in human consciousness. When the modifications cease, when distractions cease, then alone a person is established in yoga. I They say, if you and I could in this age of tension and pressure could come to such an experience of the total consciousness of an undistracted mind, we shall be able to be truly happy in spite of the ruggedness of life which we may have from time to time. In the midst of the diverse circumstances of life, we shall be able to keep our minds cool and undisturbed if we would learn the processes of yoga, those processes which lead us to psychological integration. This cessation of modification, or the totality of consciousness, was very beautifully described by a Buddhist teacher. There is a branch of Buddhism which has developed in the course of last several centuries in China and Japan. And this branch of Buddhism is known as Zen Buddhism. In this Zen Buddhism, once upon a time, a pupil approached one of the Zen masters and asked a question. He asked, "What is the spiritual discipline that you follow?" And the Zen master said, "My discipline is very simple." He said, "When I am hungry, I eat. When I am tired, I sleep." The pupil said, "Surely there is nothing new in this. Everyone does this." But the master said, "No, everyone does not do this. When you are hungry, you physically eat, but your mind is all over. When you are tired and you lie down in your bed, you are physically there in your bed, but your mind is restless, moving to all sorts of areas. And that is why you do not follow the spiritual discipline in the sense in which I understand it." This is the condition of the pupil with which we all of us are familiar, because while we may be in a state of meditation or in a state of prayer, our minds are in the marketplace. Our minds are in different places. Our minds are dealing with the problem as to how to give a proper answer to my neighbor who insulted me yesterday. You are in a state of prayer, but physically, it is only a physical pattern, but the mind is dealing with something else. Thus, we are divided within ourselves. We are not integrated. We are distracted. We are diffused. We are cut up into tiny bits. And therefore, it is this process of total attention, as described by the Zen master, which is of great value to us if we would understand the essentials of yoga. But the question of questions is, how is one to come to this undistracted condition of the mind? We all recognize, we all realize that there are tremendous pulls to our consciousness, that we are not able to give our total attention to anything, that we pile up incomplete experience after incomplete experience, and every incomplete experience pulls us. We recognize this. But the question is, how to come to this undistracted condition of the mind? May I suggest that this undistracted condition of the mind is indeed the deep awareness of consciousness. We are not aware. Our awareness is diffused. Our awareness is not deep enough. And that is why we do not comprehend many, many aspects so far as life around us is concerned. Yoga deals with deepening awareness. And through that deepening awareness, yoga brings us to a point which may be described as the point of pure awareness. To move from a distracted condition of the mind to a state of pure awareness. This indeed is the path that is revealed to us by yoga, and it is this path which surely interests us, as we would like to move along that path from the distracted mind to the condition of pure awareness. As I said, we find difficulties in concentration. We find difficulties in giving total attention. We find difficulty in putting our whole mind into any problem, into any subject that it is trying to understand. And we seem to have all sorts of fantastic ideas about concentration. We seem to be thinking that in order to concentrate, we must knit our eyebrows and we must put a pressure on our blood vessel, as if concentration has to be done through blood vessels. Remember, concentration is a process of complete relaxation. It is this relaxation which is becoming something strange in this civilization of ours. If we could be relaxed, if there could be an experience of relaxation so far as our mind is concerned, then we shall find that concentration is not difficult at all. On the contrary, concentration is something which is most easy. But how to come to it? Remember, yoga deals with four deepening states of consciousness. And it is to these four deepening states of consciousness that I want to draw your particular attention. These four deepening states of consciousness are indeed the processes of meditation. Ordinarily, we understand meditation by a threefold process: concentration, meditation proper, and contemplation. But let me point out that there is a condition prior to concentration. And if we have not come to that condition, which is prior to concentration, then I am afraid we can never come to concentration. And therefore we will not know what meditation is. Leave apart the experience of contemplation completely. What is that condition prior to concentration? Remember, that is the most practical aspect of yoga for you and for me. Because if we can go through that prior aspect of yoga, the aspect prior to concentration, then we shall be able to move rapidly along the further stages of the deepening of awareness so far as our consciousness is concerned. This prior state, the state before concentration, is recognized in true systems of yoga. This condition is known as the condition of withdrawal. That there has to take place, first of all, a withdrawal before there can take place concentration. You will say, withdrawal from what? And what is this withdrawal? This withdrawal about which I am speaking is indeed a condition where the focusing of the mind takes place. Our mind is today out of focus with reference to most things of life. It is out of focus, and because it is out of focus, There are so many things that are pulling us, making it impossible for us to come to the experience of concentration. There has therefore to be a focusing of the mind. How to do it? Remember, the focusing of the mind is the earliest stage of awareness. It is awareness with choice. It is regarded in Hindu psychology as the waking state. You and I are not in waking state. We may be physically awake, but we have not come to a waking state so far as the psychological aspect of our life is concerned. What is a waking state? If you are walking along your streets, and if you are in a waking state, as I'm sure you are most of the time, if you are in a waking state, you will be aware of the several streets and the several roads that lie before you. And as you move, you are making a choice. You are rejecting certain streets, rejecting certain paths. In this process of rejecting certain paths, you are obviously concerned with awareness with choice. This awareness with choice is therefore the first condition to which we have to come. Just as in this process of walking, you have brought your mind to a focus. You have rejected those paths which are of no use to you, along which you do not propose to go. And therefore your mind is brought to a focus so far as the one path is concerned. It is this which we have to do at the psychological level of our existence. What does it mean? It means you and I must become aware of that which we have found by our own experience as fleeting, as transient, as impermanent. I'm sure all of us have had some experience of that which has passed away, that which is no longer here. I'm not talking of something which is to be read from books or scriptures, but out of our own experience, I'm sure we can, if we sit down, find out what are the things that have moved away, what are the things that have been proved impermanent, what are the things that we have found for ourselves as fleeting? To withdraw from this is to bring the mind to a focus. This is awareness with choice. This is waking condition. This is the first state of awareness so far as the path of yoga is concerned. When we have done this, when we have dealt with all the known alternatives, knowing for ourselves that they do not lead us to the goal where we want to go, they have not given us happiness whatsoever. They have not given us peace and tranquility. We know by our own experience that these alternatives cannot be followed because they are futile. To understand for ourselves, out of our own experience, the futility of the alternatives that we have taken in the past is to bring the mind to a condition of focus. This is the focusing of the mind. This is awareness with choice. But when you have put away all the alternatives that you have found by your own experience to be futile, then what remains? That which remains is the untried alternative. That which remains is something unknown. That which remains is something about which you have no knowledge. Putting away all those things which we know as futile, the only thing that remains before our mind is the unknown and the untried. Now in front of the unknown, what is the state of consciousness? Before the unknown, the state of consciousness is awareness without choice. You have no choice whatsoever. How can you choose from the unknown? You can choose from the known. And you have found the known to be futile. The unknown is something with reference to which you cannot exercise any choice. And therefore, we are at a further state of awareness. Awareness without choice. It is what is known in Hindu psychology as the dream state. Why dream state? You know that when we have dreams, we have all types of dreams. Sometimes we appear in those dreams as villains, as evil people, as people who are certainly not very desirable. And sometimes we may appear in our own dreams as very likable people, as very loving people, as people who can really be appreciated and adored. But we have no choice so far as our dreams are concerned. When you dream yourself as a villain, you cannot say that I do not want this dream. I do not want to appear as a villain. The moment you begin to make a choice, you come back to the waking state. You are no longer in the dream state. Therefore, the dream condition is a condition where awareness exists without choice. And that is possible only when we are face to face with the unknown. And when are we face to face with the unknown? When we have realized the futility of the known. And therefore, to realize the futility of the known is of very great importance. It is this which we do not seem to be doing. And that is why our concentration seems to be so ineffective. If we can examine our known field and reject the known, knowing its futility, then we shall be very humble. The pride of knowledge will fall away. The vanity of knowledge will drop out. And therefore, there shall come to the human individual an experience of true humility. A person is humble in front of the unknown. And in front of the unknown, there can be no question of distraction. There can be no question of a diffused consciousness. In front of the unknown, the mind is held there. And therefore, there is a total and a complete attention that one shows in this condition of awareness. The awareness without choice. The awareness that is applicable to the dream state. The awareness which truly the awareness of concentration. Concentration is a condition of awareness without choice. Concentration is a condition where a person is in front of the unknown. If you want to experiment, experiment along any problem that you have. Put aside the futility of your knowledge. If you have found that your knowledge is futile, put away the futility of knowledge and you will find that you are able to concentrate because the mind is not distracted at all. The mind has really nowhere to go because its known field has been exhausted and found wanting so far as man's own experience is concerned. Concentration, therefore, is that condition which is awareness without choice. And when awareness without choice comes, there appears in the life of the human individual a further deepening of awareness, which is known in Hindu psychology as the condition of deep sleep. If in terms of awareness, one would describe this, one would say it is awareness in non-awareness. In deep sleep, there is no disturbance of dream even. In deep sleep, a man is not even aware that he is sleeping. Because if he becomes aware that he is sleeping, the deep sleep is not there. Therefore, in deep sleep, there is an awareness, but the awareness exists in non-awareness. The individual is not aware that he is aware. It is this which is truly the condition of meditation. Meditation is not a condition of thinking, not a fast, quick thinking, not an abstract thinking. On the contrary, meditation is a condition where all thinking has ceased. It is in the cessation of thinking that there is the experience of meditation. And therefore, if withdrawal is the focusing of the mind, if concentration is the relaxing of the mind, then meditation is indeed the silencing of the mind. In meditation, the mind is silent. No flicker of thought, no movement of thought, because it is awareness in non-awareness. Many a time, people say, and I myself found such questions put to me, are prayers answered? Does one receive an answer to a prayer? And to me it seems that this question is absolutely misplaced. Every prayer receives an answer, provided it is a prayer. And what is a prayer? In our prayers, we do not receive the answer. Why? We do not receive the answer because we are dictating the answer. We do not want God to give His answer. We want God to give our answer. We go on dictating the answer. The human mind dictates the answer. And when that answer does not come back, he feels that he has received no answer to the prayer. When can you receive an answer to the prayer? When your mind is silent. It is only the silent that can hear. And therefore it is the silent mind that can receive an answer to the prayer. And the silent mind is that mind in which the individual is not even aware that he is aware. In fact, that is the condition which is described in your Sermon on the Mount, where the Christ says, "Let not your left hand know what your right hand doeth." So long as the left hand knows what the right hand does, this deep sense of awareness has not come. The deep sense of awareness, which is meditation, which is deep sleep, which is the silencing of the mind, is that state where the observer has disappeared, and therefore there is just the act of observation. Many a time people say, if the observer vanishes, who observes? That which is taking place is only the act of observation, the act of perception. And where there is a pure act of perception, that indeed is the condition of meditation. In meditation, if an individual is interfering with what he perceives, then he is no longer in meditation. He has come down to a lower state of awareness. Because in meditation, the subject has disappeared, and there remains, as I said, only the act of perception or the act of observation. When we come to this state, through the focusing of the mind, through the relaxing of the mind, and through the silencing of mind, when we come to this deep sleep state, then it is that the human individual experiences something that is of tremendous importance, and that is pure awareness. The pure awareness is the condition described in yoga as the condition of contemplation. It is described in Christian mysticism as the state of ecstasy. And what is the state of ecstasy? The state of ecstasy is that state where the individual has stepped out of himself. When he steps out of himself, then only he comes to the experience of ecstasy. In meditation, in that deep sleep condition, in that awareness, in non-awareness, man has stepped out of himself, and therefore he comes to a state of ecstasy, which truly is contemplation, and which indeed is the transcending of the mind. These are therefore the four states of deepening awareness: the focusing of the mind, the relaxing of the mind, the silencing of the mind, and the transcending of the mind. And you will realize that this process of transcending the mind is carried out with the help of the mind. To transcend the mind, to transcend the limitations of the mind, with the help of the mind, this indeed is the secret of true yoga. And it is this which you and I can surely practice wherever we may be situated so far as our life is concerned. It is this pure awareness where the individual has stepped out of himself. There to him comes what is known as the self-knowledge. Ecstasy is identical with self-knowledge. When man has stepped out of himself, he truly discovers himself. And it is this discovery of oneself which gives to the human individual a tremendous sense of ecstasy. It is this, as I understand it, to which our reference is made once again in your Christian scriptures, wherein it is stated that to save one's life is to lose it, but to give one's life is to gain life eternal. To save one's life is to lose it, but when one has lost one's life, one has truly gained it. In other words, it is when man steps out of himself that he truly discovers himself. He has this knowledge which is the intimate knowledge. He has this knowledge which is the direct knowledge. He has this knowledge which is unveiled, the knowledge which is of the self, the knowledge which is of the true nature of the human individual. And when one discovers one's own self, one can understand what delight and ecstasy that would produce. And in that discovery of oneself, one lives naturally and spontaneously. Our lives are artificial. Our lives are cultivated. Our lives are not natural lives. Why? Because we have not discovered ourselves. And remember, the strain of unnatural life is always very great. The strain of artificial life is always tremendous. Because in that artificial life, there is a constant struggle to imitate somebody. The constant struggle to become somebody. And it is this which causes tension and pressure in one's psychological life. But if you and I could discover our own true nature, then in the discovery of that true nature, we shall be able to live naturally, spontaneously. All the inner tension and pressure will vanish. We will not be concerned then how to become like somebody, because we will have started our own process of becoming ourselves. It is like a musician who is full of music within himself. And then being full of music, he expresses that music. And every such expression is the process of becoming. He is never tired of that process of becoming, because every moment of that becoming is in the background of the fullness of his being. He is in the background of the discovery of himself. One of the greatest of the modern poets of India, Rabindranath Tagore, in one of his poems has beautifully illustrated this idea. He, the great poet that he was, he stands in front of the sea. What is wave after wave of sea dashing against the rocks? And the poet asks this question to the sea. Sea, what is it that you want to express? Why are your waves dashing against the rocks?
What is it that you want to tell?
What is it that you want to convey? And the sea, as it were, replies to the poet and says that through every wave that dashes against the rock, I'm trying to write the name of my beloved. But the moment I have written the name of my beloved, I wipe it off. Another wave comes. Another name of the beloved is written. But that too is wiped off. Because no name that is written is adequate to convey my experience of the beloved. But the sea says, I shall go on writing the name of my beloved for centuries and centuries. I know I cannot write it adequately, but every effort to write the name of my beloved is a joy and delight to me. The process of becoming, the process of daily existence, the process of passing through innumerable circumstances of life will be full of delight and joy to us, because in the fullness of that experience of the discovery of ourselves, we shall be able to move from expression to expression, knowing full well that no expression is adequate enough to convey the fullness of experience. And yet we shall go on and on and on, because it is a process of becoming ourselves. Become what you are was the great teaching that was given to the Hindus several centuries ago. That is the keynote of the great Upanishads of the Hindus. That certainly is the keynote of all the true systems of yoga. Become what you are. To sum up this whole teaching of yoga, I would draw your attention to three words which have formed one of the most ancient of the instructions to all spiritual aspirants. Those three words are seek, find, share. There has to be a seeking. But how can there be a seeking? In order that there may be a seeking, the mind has to be emptied of its content. The seeking is the emptying of the mind, so that the mind may be open, so that the mind may have enormous space in it. This creating of the enormous space in the mind, the emptying of the mind, this indeed is the process of seeking. And when this seeking begins, there takes place the discovery. But for seeking, as I said, there has to be a completely open mind. The moment of the emptiness of the mind, there comes the fullness of the mind. The fullness of the mind is the finding, the sharing. And when we have found, when we have discovered, then it is possible for us to go out and share. Share in the fullness. How can we share if we are not full? And therefore, before sharing, there has to be fullness. But before fullness, there has to be an emptiness. The emptiness is the seeking. The fullness is the finding, and that which results after that finding is the true sharing, the treading of the path, the going through the daily existences of life. But in the midst of all those trivialities and the details of life, there takes place this tremendously significant act of the individual sharing what he has found in the moment of the complete emptiness of his mind. As I bring this talk of mine to a close, I want to read out to you something which a Christian mystic has written. As it were, in one passage, he has summed up the whole of the problem of yoga in a beautiful manner. And I feel that I cannot end this talk of mine in a better manner than placing before you these most inspiring words of a Christian mystic. The Christian mystic describes here a conversation between the scholar, the pupil, and the master. This is what the pupil says. How may I come to the super sensual life that I may see God and hear him speak? The master says, when thou canst throw thyself for a moment into that where no creature dwelleth, then thou hearest what God speaketh. The pupil said, is it near at hand or far away? The master says, it is in thee. If thou canst for a while cease from all thinking and willing, thou shalt hear the unspeakable words of God. But the pupil again asks, how can I hear when I stand still from thinking and willing? The master says, when thou standest still from the thinking and willing of self, then the eternal hearing, the eternal seeing, and the eternal speaking will be revealed to thee. This is the path of yoga, the path of pure awareness, the awareness of our true self, the awareness in which there is the eternal hearing, there is the eternal speaking, and there is the eternal seeing. This is the vision eternal. And when this vision comes, for man, the path of spiritual life is no longer a path of woe. It becomes a path of joy indescribable.